Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of the sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Broad, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Brand new week begins. It's about 2 minutes past the hour, 6 p.m. Yes, we got it right. Thanks for the words of warning and words of hey Bob, you know the clocks change again, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And fortunately, much of that is automated, so we were not blindsided or caught unawares. And yeah, on the air at the right time and everything. Three cheers and a tiger for us. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the link to the chat room. That's where you'll find the Listen Live button. And, of course, you can always listen live via other applications, streaming platforms like TuneIn Radio or Stitcher Radio, both of which have good apps for your smart devices, your tablet devices, what have you. And, of course, also at the website, headonradionetwork.com, you will find the PayPal button. The PayPal button is how we actually keep all of this going. That's how we pay the bills. We found ourselves ending the month of October in a hole, and we are starting November in one as well, but much less of one thanks to the kind efforts of Janie. Thank you, Janie, very much. Janie single-handedly took care of two-thirds of tonight's fundraising, leaving only $50 to go, which would mean that we've only got 300 and some odd dollars, I guess, to dig out of the hole. So thank you very much, Janie. That takes a tremendous amount of pressure off the whole process. So if anybody else would like to help Janie, I'm sure Janie would appreciate it, and I know we would. Something via a match. Or something via, because sweating the phone bill, sweating the internet bill, sweating it, all the things we sweat here. It's a tough road to hoe. Yes, I know what day it is. It's Monday. It is Moran Monday on the Horn, and we have a surfeit of Morans. And we've got one of our lead nominees. We'll be discussing one of our lead Moran Monday nominees here in just a few minutes. Got a guest calling in, a friend. Moran will be on the phone with me here in a few minutes. Steve, if you don't know, is a well-known liberal progressive writer. He's based in Madison, Wisconsin. And he's a research fellow at DSmog Blog, which is one of my go-to favorite sites for finding out the skullduggery of the people who would like to poison us right off of this planet. You know, eliminate the ability of humans to live here, except for maybe the 1% in their biodomes, and frankly, they can have Pauly Shore for all I care. But he also has written at The Guardian, Alternet, The Nation, Truth Out, Counterpunch, Nation of Change, Common Dreams, and PR Watch. His name has also appeared on articles at Think Progress. So suffice to say that Steve has good credentials, and it is in fact a post of his at the Smog Blog, which I became aware over the weekend that we will be discussing, because oddly enough, we've been discussing the topic. One of the topics of that Smog Blog post in the last couple of weeks. He's up a couple of different times. That would be Murray Energy headman, titan of industry, whatever, Bob Murray, or as I like to refer to him, the hero of Crandall Canyon. Steve has a very interesting story about some of Bob Murray's latest antics, and we will be discussing them in short order, with Bob Murray being an obvious frontrunner nominee for tonight's Moran Monday award. Oh, but Lord, we've got other Moran Monday nominees. Yes, we do. Oh, we certainly do. The fallout, and I guess we can call it that, can't we? The fallout from Halloween is greater than anything I have seen in recent memory. Just the stupid stuff. No, not talking about people's houses getting egged or TP'd, although that wound up getting a boy peppered pretty good with a shotgun blast down in Franklin County, Tennessee. No, not that sort of thing at all. It's the fallout from people who are obsessed with inappropriate behavior. Like the very, very white football coaches at a high school in San Diego, California, who went to a Halloween party dressed as the not-white members of the Cool Runnings bobsled team from the movie of the same name. Remember Cool Runnings? Oh, that's really funny. Bunch of people from Jamaica going to have a bobsled team. that's something. I don't care who you are. That's funny. Right? Right. Well, they did, and they showed up in blackface. Really? Here, on this Moran Monday, right here, right now, on the fourth day of November 2013, can we just establish a rule that blackface is no longer okay? I mean, I thought we had that one covered. I thought there were things that weren't really necessary to be explained anymore, but apparently are. Real plain-like. If you are a pale person, you don't get to wear blackface. I don't care if it's Halloween, Easter, 4th of July. Don't care. You don't get to do blackface. Even if something inside you says, yeah, but I've got the look and I'm going this Halloween as Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer. No, you don't get to. Because if you do, the whole world is going to note you for being the horse's rear end that you most assuredly are. And no, little right-wingers who still want to do blackface, you don't get to complain that you're being subjected to political correctness. Because offense, like beauty, is whether or not these football coaches, for instance, who were immediately reinstated to the football program in time to go and be on the sidelines for the football game that night, whether they intended, well, we didn't intend to offend anybody, like, you know, doesn't matter. And the apology that follows that says, we're sorry if anybody was offended, no, that doesn't work either. Fail. Epic fail. So you get the idea, but no, you'd be surprised at the clueless people who somehow or another can't figure it out. Oh, hell no. What a Halloween fallout this year. But if you thought the high school football coaches showing up in blackface as the Jamaican bobsled team from Cool Runnings, if you thought that was bad. No, there's worse. No, there's considerably worse. And by the way, blackface rubber masks are not an out. No, not at all. But yes, it does get worse. To wit, a mother who just wanted to make sure that her precious little one had a wonderful, fun, inspiring, delightful Halloween. I talked about the fun of Halloween. Oh, stand back for a moment. Silly me, I gave Steve Horn the wrong darn phone number. I talked about it the other night, the joy of seeing your little ones get up in their costumes. You know, for instance, our little grandchildren, we had a Ninja Turtle, a Superman, and a Batman princess. Adorable, huh? Well, apparently, Jessica Black wanted her child to have an adorable Halloween, too. Jessica Black lives in the Old Dominion, Virginia. And Craigsville, Virginia. Oddly enough, I know where Craigsville, Virginia is. I've driven through there on the way to D.C. because I like to go off the beaten path. And it is kind of out in the hinterlands, and it's not far from the border with West Virginia. So she sends her precious little son out to trick-or-treat the other night in a Klan costume. When some people began pushing back and talking about what a moron she was for sending her son, her little, you know, maybe first grade level age son, as a Kleagel of the Klan, she said, she just didn't understand. She said, well, it's supposed to be white with white, black with black, man with woman, and all of that. I don't get it. And now she claims that she has received threats via Facebook. Threats. I'm betting, since it's pretty obvious that she's a moron, that she doesn't know the difference between a threat and a criticism, such as, what were you thinking sending your child out trick-or-treating as a Klansman? You know, the white bed sheet robe with the stupid little insignia, and yes, the pointy hood with the two eyes cut out, and the trick-or-treat bag. We call this Moron Monday for a reason. And with it being Moran Monday, and, the coal industry is right chock full of morans, some of them ludicrous, others of them quite dangerous. Like I said a couple of minutes ago, we're going to talk with Steve Horn about his latest piece over at DSmog Blog about Bob Murray, the hero of Crandall Canyon, of Murray Energy. Hey, Steve, are you there?
I'm here.
My apologies for the screwed-up phone number. I was typing in a hurry yesterday, I guess, and I gave you the wrong one. That's what you get with these one-man band operations. What are you going to do? You know, someday I'll have a staff.
Exactly.
But, I really was. The minute I read the article, I wanted to make sure that we had a conversation about this because I never cease to be amazed at the brass of particularly executives in the coal industry. I mean, talk about a privileged bunch. And Bob Murray is among the brassiest. Is that safe to say?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, especially his actions since early 2012 has kind of put him in somewhat of the league of his own, along with a few others, maybe the Koch brothers. And it's a very small class of people, but he's in it.
So just to review, this is the same Bob Murray who compelled his workers at an Ohio coal mine to serve as stage props for a Mitt Romney rally, right?
Correct, yeah, and that happened during the campaign last year, and since then he's been on somewhat of a rampage against everyone and anyone who opposes him, including the latest that I wrote about was a blogger by the name of Mike Stark, who wrote an article about him and his campaign contributions to Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican candidate for governor in Virginia. He wrote an article about the fact that Murray was the biggest donor so far that's been tracked down to Cuccinelli to a total of $30,000. So he went on to explain who Murray was, looking at his past, and he made potentially the mistake of calling him an extremist using that one word. Murray went on to bring a defamation lawsuit against Mike Stark, and all the other things that were facts in his articles he called defamation, even though the only thing that was more or less just an opinion was the extremist part. Everything else was a fact that Murray had done, basically his track record of what he did during the 2012 campaign, and that one word cost Stark, unfortunately, a lot of time and grief with this lawsuit against a very powerful individual that's ongoing.
Well, I think a lot of people, a lot of members of the Horn family commune, as we call it here, will recognize the name of Mike Stark. He is a serious reporter of fossil fuel related activities, among other things. He runs the Stark Reports, as you note. He's the creator of FossilAgenda.com. The post that got him sued was, it was an exercise in journalism, was it not?
Basically, yeah. I mean, the only thing that was opinion, which is totally protected speech under the First Amendment, was to call Murray extremist. Everything else was facts. It was just things he'd done, such as, you mentioned the using the workers as props for the campaign event. Other things that he did was the prayer after the election last year when Obama got elected. A prayer was made public that Murray gave to the United States because he said the United States would turn into a socialist country because Obama was elected. These kinds of things. So these are all documented facts. Everything in Stark's article had web links to it, and the only very opinionated thing in it, and it obviously had a slant, but the only more opinionated thing on it, in my opinion, was just calling him an extremist. But I think a lot of Americans would probably agree that Murray's behavior is extreme, but on top of that, that's just First Amendment protected speech. But Murray, the way I see it, is using this lawsuit more as an intimidation tactic and a way to try to silence people and scare people into writing articles about him. And it's kind of another one in the line of examples. Another example is he brought a defamation lawsuit against Ken Ward Jr., the very well-known.
Oh, I know him, yes.
Colby, yeah. So this is, he's another well-known guy who, and those are just two of several. So this is Murray's sort of new frontier, is bringing lawsuits against journalists and bloggers.
It's kind of shocking to me that and Mike Stark, let's be clear, does have some competent counsel behind him in defending this, but when these intimidation lawsuits are brought, Steve, do they have the effect of hindering or hampering the otherwise good work that the victim of the lawsuit is trying to do?
Yeah, and that's the argument that Mike Starr's counsel, he's represented by the ACLU of Ohio and by David Halperin, who used to be the senior vice president of the Center for American Progress. The argument they make is that this is a frivolous lawsuit by Murray, just meant to deter Stark from doing otherwise, things that are in the public interest, like exposing what the coal industry is doing. Doing journalism that holds these big corporations accountable. The point of the lawsuit, they say, is they don't really, Murray doesn't have much legal grounds. The two arguments he makes is that it was defamation and that it was also a false light invasion of privacy. He made the claim that he wasn't a very public individual when obviously he has been.
Yeah, that's the one that jumped out and grabbed me. This is a guy who, during Crandall Canyon, couldn't get close enough to the cameras and the microphones. This is a guy who issued a public prayer saying, Lord, forgive me for the people I'm going to have to fire from their jobs because Obama is a socialist. This is a guy who has very publicly given $30,000 to a right-wing extremist in Virginia, which was the centerpiece of the whole piece that Mike Stark wrote, the fact that he's given $30,000 to Ken Cuccinelli.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, he makes the argument, you know, two-tiered argument. One is that it was defamation, then the contradictory claim that not only was it defamation, but also that it was an invasion of privacy, even though defamation, the connotation of the word is that you're defaming someone who's famous, so it doesn't even make sense. But that's why most people I talk to who have legal acumen, they don't think that this is about the legal part of it. It's just a way to deter someone like Mike Stark or any other journalist from their full-time job and making them spend time on this case and gathering the legal arguments and just deterring them and intimidating them. And that's basically the main reason for this case. It's not, I don't even think that Murray is super serious about this. He uses these as sort of public relations opportunities and, but even more importantly than that, intimidation opportunities.
How interesting. He uses a lawsuit that he files to create publicity for himself when at the same time he, out of the other side of his mouth, is claiming that he is not a public person.
Right.
You know, you and I as rational human beings, that would make our heads explode, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think as David Halperin says, someone like Murray, he's also rational. He's not irrational so much. He's rational. He knows exactly what he's doing, and what he's doing is using his entrenched power to, you know, basically create a chilling effect for other people who may want to look into him in the future. May make them think twice about doing it because of the consequences of potentially having to go through a lawsuit and potentially having to pay money. And there's all kinds of things that he doesn't have to worry about too much. He has a very high-powered legal team. Stark was lucky. You know, he got a good legal team. Maybe someone else won't in the future. They may think, oh, well, I can't get that kind of legal team, and I don't think I want to take that. So it's the chilling effect that's the most important part here.
Well, let me ask you this. In the course of talking to lawyers about this story, Steve, have any of them posited any sort of a way to stop this conduct? I mean, this is deeply disturbing. I mean, I thought there were supposed to be things within the legal framework that would prevent lawyers from filing frivolous lawsuits.
Well, you know, so I've talked quite a bit to David Halperin, one of Stark's attorneys behind the scenes, and there's no really talk about the fact about how this can be prevented. And I also talked to Free Press, an organization that works to, you know, embolden journalists and, you know, kind of create a more robust independent media. And they think that this is just creating a really horrifying precedent, for someone else might see what Murray's doing in the coal industry or say the fracking industry or any other industry. They might see it as, oh, wow, this is a really successful tool in our playbook to try to intimidate journalists from doing their jobs. So, if anything, I think it's the pendulum swings in the other direction of this troubling new trend of powerful people using the legal system to intimidate people who are doing their job, which is holding people in power accountable.
And these lawsuits have a technical name, or a colloquial name, maybe, SLAP suits. What does SLAP stand for?
Yeah, so that's a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And in Ohio, there's no SLAP. In Texas, there is SLAP. And it was, I kind of draw the parallel to activists who were protesting against the Keystone XL pipeline down there. They were handed a SLAP lawsuit by TransCanada, and that meant that basically TransCanada is admitting that their activity is hurting TransCanada's bottom lines, corporate profits, and because of that, those activists should stop immediately. So it really shows the sort of the corporate entrenched nature of, you know, how much power corporations do have in the U.S. legal system. In this case, I said that this the Stark case and other cases that Murray has brought, he's really using the legal system as SLAP as well, but instead of doing it towards activists, it's towards journalists, but it plays a similar role, and that's to chill people from doing what they're doing in the future. They're maybe thinking twice about doing it because of what the consequences will be. And I know that just as an example, after that slap lawsuit was brought against the activists down in Texas, I know their activity was curtailed quite a bit, and that a lot of these activists' time had to be spent protecting themselves legally so they didn't have to, you know, go to jail or something like that or pay huge fines. So it really does have a very negative impact on these things that are, I would say, good for democracy, but they don't really help corporate bottom lines.
And just to be clear, you've mentioned a couple of instances here. The use of these abusive, intimidatory lawsuits is not something new. In fact, it is a growing phenomenon within the corporate culture, especially in the hydrocarbon corporate culture. Is it not?
It very much is. And, you know, I actually have I'll just talk about it on air. I have a personal example. I got lucky. They didn't harass me more than they did. But Aubrey McClendon, the former CEO of Chesapeake Energy, I wrote an article about him and his new corporate venture that he started after he got booted as the CEO of Chesapeake. And I got a similar type of, letter from the attorney saying, if you don't change this and this and this and this, we may give you a lawsuit. So it's not just in coal. No, I mean, it's in the fracking sphere too. He didn't press me further, but since that article has come out, I've thought long and hard about what kind of articles I want to write about McClendon. And it definitely does have a chilling effect. When I saw his one of his attorneys was, one of the former heads or legal counsel of the SEC, I'm start thinking, oh my gosh, I really don't want to get into this kind of legal trouble. It's expensive and I don't have that kind of money. So that's the point of this. And that's the scary thing. That's the scary precedent being set.
Well, with that in mind, Steve, tell me this. Does this speak to a need for some sort of legal rapid response team that can, on behalf of people beset by phony, baloney, frivolous lawsuits like this, does this speak to the need of some sort of rapid response team that can get out there and handle these things for people, or are there already such things in place? I mean, you mentioned obviously the Ohio ACLU jumping in on Mike Stark's behalf, but what are the nuts and bolts of what happens when you get hit with one of these things?
Well, yeah, so I think that there is nothing like that in place now. I've had a conversation with Free Press, as I mentioned earlier, and they're becoming increasingly interested in this because they also see this as a kind of a new, it's not a brand new phenomenon, it's happened to activists, but in terms of journalists being attacked basically these corporate powers and using these slap-like lawsuits, this is it's a new phenomenon that's becoming bigger, more quickly, and they're talking about what they can do as an organization and with other organizations that work to keep a free press in the United States, first of all, an education of what the nature of the problem is, and second of all, what can we do about it once it happens. So I think it's still something that's in the works, but I think that it's something that's being taken a lot more seriously by people who do work on press freedom issues.
And are these things being... you mentioned Ken Ward, who of course works for the Charleston Gazette, and we're dealing here with in this instant story with Mike Stark. Is this an issue? Is it pointed in one direction or another? Is there a preference for trying to take down independent voices over ones who work for major press outlets, or is it just targets of opportunity?
I think that it's not just limited to the independent journalists. If you look at Murray's track record, it's actually mostly against more establishment, more mainstream media type of voices, such as Ward and other local papers that cover the coal industry. Essentially, it could be anyone who writes any story that these industries don't like, that may shed unfavorable light on them. But, it's probably the truth, and, the First Amendment protects freedom of the press, and it doesn't say that stories can only be published if corporations like them. So I think it's a real test of if the First Amendment still has meaning in the United States. And, I mean, I think it's important to note, although we've talked about the nature of the problem, Murray hasn't won any of these lawsuits. He doesn't bring the lawsuits to win. He just brings the lawsuits to deter. But I think that in of itself, I think people, judges should see that he's bringing these cases, that it's become a trend, and really just throw them out you know, right off the bat, especially when they don't have much legal merit. It becomes problematic when what he's doing is just roping journalists into these lawsuits that have no grounds, but you know, they make them spend the time and effort and money to defend themselves. So I think it's something that court systems need to look into more closely. I think it's something that even at the federal judicial level needs to be looked at more closely, say at the Department of Justice level of the United States. If it becomes bigger and bigger, I think it's still a little bit too small to say right now, but I do think that it's becoming a bigger and bigger phenomenon. I think Murray is definitely leading the way, and he'll be, if anything, if it does get bigger, he'll be seen as the kind of creating the landmark lawsuits and the playbook for it.
You would think that there would, I mean, there's a long history of case law on this kind of thing that goes back through Falwell versus Hustler, New York Times versus Sullivan, mm-hmm. way back that says that this stuff is supposed to be disposed of almost out of hand when you read what the courts say about them. There is a motion to dismiss this lawsuit pending in the Belmont County, Ohio Court of Common Pleas. Can we hope or dare we hope that a judge will take a look at this and recognize it for the vindictive, frivolous thing that it is and just toss it?
Well, I think that it has promise. I've looked at both the complaint by Murray Energy and basically the complete lack of citation of any legal precedent. And then you look at, compare and contrast that to the motion to dismiss, which does cite the cases that you just cited and a lot more of them besides that. You look at, if a judge looks at it on its merits, the legal merits, definitely the motion to dismiss wins. I think that even if it wins, I think Murray still has played his cards, and he may see it as a victory because he's intimidated a blogger. I don't think that Mike Stark is particularly intimidated, but I do know that during this time he has to be a lot more quiet about what he says than he would like to be. So even if, say that the motion to dismiss prevails, it's still the trend of doing it just to silence someone for maybe a month or 2 months or 3 months. That can be a lot of time, quickly based on how quickly, the coal industry moves, does mergers and acquisitions, that kind of thing. I know that during this time period where Stark is caught up in this lawsuit, Murray Energy sold off 5 of its West Virginia coal mines to Council Energy. And I think, that's a story that has a lot of...
Well, actually, it's the other way around.
Other way around, yes.
Yeah, Consol sold a bunch of five mines to Murray Energy. And
exactly. Consol said that they're going to kind of shift more of their resources to the direction of fracking. That said, that Consol tie to the Cuccinelli campaign was an interesting one because there's a scandal about Cuccinelli ripping landowners off of their royalties, using the Attorney General's office to do so. There could have been all kinds of stories that may have come from that Stark was interested in looking into, or maybe someone else was, but Stark's a good example because he actually did look into that council. So he can't even report on that right now or even look into it because he's caught up in this lawsuit. So I think that's sort of a perfect case in point. Is the purpose of these lawsuits is just to deter someone from long enough that maybe an important story will be here or there at some point, and they just can't really talk publicly about it or comment on that company because they're caught up in a legal case surrounding it. And I think that's the more problematic aspect of this whole thing.
And there's another aspect, though, isn't there, Steve, insofar as lawsuits like this discourage more mainstream outlets from picking up coverage, don't they?
For sure, yeah. And I do want to point to what happened in the New York Times. They did this huge investigation, 3 parts, by Ian Urbina on fracking a couple of years ago. Since then, the New York Times hasn't really had as much of an investigative spirit around this issue. I know that the gas industry attacked Urbina quite a bit. Groups like Energy and Depth, the American Natural Gas Alliance, the whole echo chamber. And, Ian Urbina is pretty spooked to look into them again. So, it's a mainstream journalist, but he's a very good journalist and, a well-intentioned one. But he gets pressure from his editors and they may not be looking into the gas industry that closely like that for quite a long time because of basically the silencing effect that it has. So it probably won't silence someone like Stark, and it won't silence independent reporters, but the mainstream media, they're a lot quicker to kind of quiet down after they do a big investigation when
they flinch, so they blink.
They flinch, they blink, and, you know, these stories go by. And, I mean, I do think that that's another, just, you know, putting a, kind of a lot, lauding the independent media because it's a lot more fearless and they'll flinch a lot less. But either way, I think no one benefits when people like Robert Murray are bringing these types of frivolous lawsuits.
Well, let me ask you a little bit, Steve, about your own work with DSmog Blog. I've been reading DSmog Blog for a very long time. What do you see as the signal? I mean, is there a sort of pinnacle of or a laser beam focus of what the reporting y'all do over there needs to be on? I'm obviously up to my eyeballs in mountaintop removal by virtue of where I live and what I do. And that sort of puts a bubble around me so that I can look out and I can see fracking, I can see the Keystone XL pipeline. But, you know, when the toxic dust is blowing off the mountains, it creates kind of a haze around everything else. What is from your perspective, and I even hesitate to use the word environmental, but what is the, moment or the issue that's out there right now that is bigger than anything else?
Well, I mean, yeah, obviously the fight of the Keystone XL pipeline has been one that's been going on for a couple of years. I think that's kind of seen as a legacy type of decision for President Obama going forward. I don't actually think that that's the number one hottest issue ever. I mean, at the end of the day, it's still a pipeline. There's lots of pipelines in the United States, but it's the one that President Obama does have the final say over. So I think that's how the environmental community sees it. The way I see it is that all these issues are completely interconnected, you know, and the thing that connects them is runaway climate change. And just to point to the upcoming UN climate summit in Poland, that's, you know, what's the global community going to do about climate change? I think that's obviously, to me, has to be the biggest issue of them all, because that's, you know, the rampant extraction of fossil fuels and what it's done to the climate is that's the kind of the biggest issue of our time. So I think that's the theme of DSmog. We try to cover coal, we try to cover fracking, we try to cover tar sands, all of them, because we see, you know, the common connection is definitely climate change. And that was why the blog originally started, was actually just to kind of look at the men behind the curtain, the climate change denial machine, the people who were lying about climate change. Now it's become that, and also covering what are these industries up to from lots of perspectives, whether it's PR, whether it's business, whether it's pipelines, et cetera.
Well, you're, of course, based in Wisconsin. Do you have any insight on the latest shenanigans up there relative to the attempt to take away any local control from communities to prevent themselves from being blasted into oblivion?
Yeah, so that was a really hot issue, just a week and a half ago, where there's a hearing, committee hearing on a bill to take away local control or zoning of any of the frac sand mines and other type of mines in the state of Wisconsin. The bill will not be brought forth this year. It may have just been a PR opportunity for the frac sand industry, the ones who wrote the bill, the Wisconsin Industrial Sand Organization, but it's kind of unclear. Depends on what happens early next year. It may be brought forward again and seen on the whole floor of both chambers of Congress or the legislature, or might not. But either way, really, I think that that's one of the most powerful lobbies in the state right now is the frac sand lobby, because Wisconsin is basically the global epicenter of frac sand, and this frac sand is used to blast down wells in fracking wells around the United States and around the world as a proppant to open up wells to get the gas or the oil up from the other end when you do fracking.
Because most people who listen to this program, Steve, they know what fracking is, they know what the tar sands pipeline is, they know obviously what mountaintop removal is. Can you give a quick primer on frac sand mining?
Yeah, sure. So frac sand is the name that activists have given it. What it really is it is frac sand. It's used for fracking, but it's fine-grained silica sand. So it's kind of shaped like a kind of perfect crystal ball, tiny crystal ball, sometimes known as crystalline silica. And it has a perfect shape and perfect size when taken in en masse with the mix of lots of water, a large amount of chemicals relative to the cocktail, a small amount of chemicals. And then it's blasted down a fracking well, both first about 5,000 feet down and 5,000 feet horizontally, and used to, sometimes known as a proppant also, used to prop open small fissures in the well that the gas can travel back up in the other direction through. So it's seen sort of as gold, basically, in the state of Wisconsin and in Minnesota, but particularly in Wisconsin, and that's because getting it's a lot cheaper than making artificial proppants that are made in factories in different places, but it's a lot more expensive, so the industry does see it as its cheapest way of getting something that is necessary to obtain the gas. And so that's why Wisconsin is really on the bullseye of the oil and gas industry. There was a conference recently that Governor Scott Walker spoke at, and lots of other lobbyists were there, executives, that kind of thing. And, he got up and said that Wisconsin is the global epicenter for frac sand. So it's a huge issue here.
What are we talking about in terms of tonnage, Steve?
Well, I couldn't tell you that. I could tell you that there are something like 180 mines right now open in the state, which has just exploded. I think as of about 3 years ago, there were something like a few dozen mines. So just to show how quickly, it's proliferated and it's getting bigger and bigger. There's lots of towns that are having hearings about opening up new mines. I live in Dane County, which is where Madison's located. Dane County does have frac sand, but there's no mines yet, but it's being talked about here. So it's it's an increasingly huge issue, and citizens are particularly concerned because basically breathing in this silica sand, this fine-grained silica, can cause lung cancer, silicosis, that kind of thing. And it's also on the radar of the federal government through OSHA. OSHA does see it as a huge workplace hazard for workers who work on well sites for fracking. So, it's becoming, fracking is a lot more famous than frac sand, but it's becoming a much bigger issue, and it has become kind of...
Just to be clear, Steve, this does involve, you hear the word mining, and for a lot of people that conjures up images of guys with lights on their heads going underground with a pick and a shovel, and this is not that. This is massive surface blasting scale mining, is it not?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, in a place like Iowa, it might involve some hillside removal, kind of like mini mountaintop, not the type of mountaintop removal that you're familiar with, but sort of like getting rid of huge amounts of hillsides in beautiful areas is an example. That's what's being talked about in Iowa, another place where that's frac sand. But I think the dominant theme is definitely what you just mentioned, if you go around different places in the state, you just see these huge kind of open pits that have been created by digging up all this sand in such huge amounts.
Well, I worry because one of the things that has been an absolute factor for change in the way that we're approaching mountaintop removal here, Steve, is what we have learned through these published scientific reports about the toxicity of the blasting agents in combination with things like silica, because of course we have a lot of sandstone that's over top of coal. Welcome to Geology 101. And the blasting that takes place and the ultrafine particles that are created, these things are the size of a virus, and they among other things, one of the scientists recently told me, these ultrafine particles, when you breathe them, they transmit through the lining of the lungs. They don't just stay in the lungs. They go to other parts of the body, of the body systems. And among other things, they will transit the placental barrier in a pregnant woman. And these ultrafines will also transit the blood-brain barrier in any human being. And what we're finding is this explosion of cancers and heart disease and birth defects. And everything that we're hearing suggests that it has to do with the particulate dust. So what, you know, the hard lessons that we've learned in hospitals and funeral homes here in Appalachia for the last a dozen or so years, closer to 15 now, are if there is not some relief had for people dealing with frac sand mining, and Lord knows if they get away with blasting the Pinoki Hills up in Ashland and Iron Counties, those are lessons that people in Wisconsin are going to get to learn 15 years from now. So it is better stopped
exactly.
It's better stopped on the front end than it is having to learn the hard lessons later.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole thing is that there haven't been a whole lot of health studies done. I mean, also it's an unprecedented thing to do, this frac sand mining. It's brand new. It hasn't, you know, it started maybe in 2008, 2009, 2010. It really got big after 2010, once fracking became a very national issue, as opposed to just one that was happening in the Northeast around Pennsylvania. And no one really knows what the long-term health impacts will be. And like you said, maybe people, you know, unfortunately will have to learn from all these illnesses that they never had in these rural areas of Wisconsin until the frac sand industry came around the corner. So that's the scary part.
And I think there's a larger issue here, and I won't keep you much longer. I really appreciate the time you've shared with us, Steve. But there's also an issue here, and that is, and I think we can identify it in mountaintop removal. We can identify it in fracking. We can identify it in frac sand mining. We can there is, and I don't know if this is a function of capitalism or a function of just plain blind arrogant stupidity, but within the structure we deal with in this country, and tell me if I'm wrong, we assume that anything that somebody says can make them a buck is a good thing, and then on the back end we start wondering about, hey, are we poisoning anybody? And that seems, to someone who likes to pride himself on being rational, that seems like it's precisely the bass-ackwards way of going about it. Are we going to poison people? A, yes. B, no. No, proceed with caution. A, yes, you don't go any further. They have processes like this in civilized parts of the world, you know, Europe, things like that, right? But not here, and not in the developing world.
Yeah, I would say that the developing world has been very culpable for first using the using the undeveloped world as sort of its colonized region to do these extractive methods. I think what's happening in the United States, and I don't say this because, you know, I'm not saying it because people deserve it here, but I am saying that a lot of people in the U.S. domestically are feeling what a lot of people say, you know, in, maybe in the Middle East, to use an example, have dealt with for a long time, as the United States has been importing Middle Eastern oil that it got, you know, maybe from wars or from colonization. It's happening here, and it's a domestic colonization where these extractive industries are now tapping into the resources here and coming into communities, and people are, you know, people without a voice really, or aren't given enough of a voice in rural communities, are feeling the consequences of it. And I think it behooves every American to really see what's happening in communities and talk to some of these people. You know, they're people like us. It's just that, you know, perhaps some people haven't seen what these sites look like, but once you see them, it will change your life forever. And I think that's the situation we're dealing with is, you know, those was talked about, for example, in Gasland too. One of the representatives from Texas said the same thing. He said that this is what the United States has done around the world for quite a long time, but now people in Texas and the Barnett Shale, right, you know, they're seeing what it's like, and it becomes a question of what kind of society do you want to live in, and what kind of world do you want to live in. And I think with this rampant climate change, it's something we all have to think about very closely, all in the context of the upcoming climate negotiations in Poland coming up this month.
Well, I think those will be. You're not going over to cover them, are you?
I'm not going, but actually, two people from the Smog Blog are my boss and the editor of the blog, Brendan Dimel, and the founder of the blog, Kevin Grandi, are both going over to Poland.
Oh, Kevin's a buddy of mine.
Yeah, so kind of, yeah, they'll both be there, and you'll probably see a lot of coverage, kind of breaking coverage from the negotiations from the Smog Blog in the coming weeks.
Well, if you happen to be in communication with them, Steve, please, especially Kevin, ask him if he wouldn't mind giving us an update from there, because it seems with every one of these meetings that we get a little closer to as if we're not already in crisis. But with every one of these meetings, the deniers ramp up, and it seems like it's actually getting harder to get anything done as opposed to what should be simpler. So,
right. One thing I'll say just on the last note is that even the business press now, Bloomberg had a big article today talking about, with people who were involved at the Kyoto negotiations years back, talking about how they think that, unfortunately, even if an agreement is struck, based on what people are talking about, that agreement won't be enough to get to runaway climate change, the 2-degree mark. And I do think that a lot of people are waking up a lot more to this, and we're going to see some interesting things. I think this is going to be a really interesting rest of the decade, next 10 years, around climate change in the United States. And that's what unites all these issues, frac sand, talk about coal, we can talk about fracking. But the centralizing theme and what's going to bring them all together is what the world is going to do to tackle climate change as we go forward.
Well, you're doing awfully good work, Steve, and I appreciate you letting me know that this article had come out. People can go to dsmogblog.com and read it. Can they particularly follow your posts, or they can certainly just follow everything that comes up on DSmog blog, right?
Yeah, you can also if you're just interested in following my stuff, there's every person who writes for the blog has their own little portal on the website, so you can follow my stuff on there if you just search my name in the search bar for DSmog blog.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time this evening, Steve, and I hope this will be the first of many conversations and not the last.
Thanks for having me.
And as things develop with this lawsuit, will you be writing more?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, just to close on that lawsuit where we started, there's a 2-week deadline for the prosecutors, in this case, Murray's attorneys, to respond to the motion to dismiss. So, listeners should definitely check out the Smog blog. I'll be writing about whatever the response is, and that response will have to be given by about the middle of November. So keep an eye for that.
Okay, great. Well, Steve Horn, thank you very, very kindly. I appreciate the hard work that you do and the good work that you do, and I look forward to us talking again.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
My pleasure. Take care, Steve. Steve Horn of dsmogblog.com. You can find the article in question at that website. The title, Coal Baron and Major Ken Cuccinelli Campaign Donor Sues Blogger for Defamation, Invasion of Privacy. It frustrates me to no end that the Bob Murrays of the world can get away with this. There are actually supposed to be embedded in the rules of procedure things that apply to lawyers signing pleadings on behalf of their clients that one would think would stop this kind of foolishness. Sadly, as we see here, it doesn't. And I just wonder why it is that when lawyers for people like Bob Murray file this trash, this unmitigated, meretricious garbage, why they're not slapped down a rat hole by the opposition filing a motion saying, don't just dismiss this suit. Find the lawyer who filed it and maybe take his license, too. But I guess I'm just mean that way. So it is obviously our first nominee for Moran Monday is public, non-public figure Bob Murray, the hero of Crandall Canyon, who incidentally showed up to speak at a pro-coal rally in, I guess, Bluefield, Virginia. And brought with him an Impeach Obama sign. Now, if you're not a public figure, it would seem contrary to reason that you would be invited to be a public speaker and that you would bring your impeach Obama sign and invite people to become part of your impeach Obama movement. I mean, this is a real sleazy character. This is a guy who, in 2010, wrote to his employees whom he deemed were not giving till it hurts to his Murray Energy pack. See, he leans on people who work for a salary in his company to kick back parts of their salary to the Murray Energy Political Action Committee. And as in September 2010, he wrote the following: "The response to this letter of appeal has been poor. We have only a little over a month left to go in this election fight. If we do not win it, the coal industry will be eliminated, and so will your job if you want to remain in this industry." And that's apparently legal. One of his employees said, "There's a lot of coercion. I just wanted to work, but you feel this constant pressure that if you don't contribute, your job's at stake. You're compelled to do this whether you want to or not." Another employee said, "They'll give you a call if you're not giving. It's expected you give Mr. Murray what he asks for." And yet this is the jackass who filed the suit against someone who did nothing more than write about facts. Because you see, when you take quotes like that, you find out real quick that Bob Murray is an extremist. By any metric. "Y'all want to impeach him, Obama? I want to impeach him, Obama." By the way, he predicted we would all be socialists by now if Obama won re-election. I know. You sit around waiting for the program to come on, and while you do so, you whistle the Internationale. Jesus. Big thanks going out to Darlene. She has put a $100 challenge on the table for this evening, in essence responding to Janie and hoping to carry it forward to help dig us out of this hole that we are in. $100 challenge from Darlene for anybody who wishes to participate. 10 at 10, 2 at 50, 4 at 25, 3 at 33 and a third. 5 at 20, 20 at 5. That's the extent of my math on the fly. So that's our first nominee for Moran Monday here on the Horn. Please believe me when I say there are coming. There are more coming. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There are more coming. So we'll take a little break and then be back for this Eastern Standard Time edition of Moran Monday. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn.
A hard place, and I'm dead. I'm a desperate man. 10 lawyers, guns and money. The shit has hit the fan. Guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money.
I love the way he growls that, the late, great Warren Zevon. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Kind of a piratey noise, and well, it kind of fits for people like Bob Murray, who would simply seek to silence people he doesn't like. See, in Bob Murray's 1% world, not liking somebody, something that somebody likes means that that speech needs to stop existing. Is there any greater proof of un-Americanism than something like that? Because it seems pretty stark to me. No, like I said, we got lots of more in Monday today. Oh, mercy. Now, this one just grabbed me because it's kind of a twofer. On the one hand, you've got another lawful, awful gun owner gone bad. On the other, you've got just plain stupid, which is, of course, what Moran Monday was created to commemorate. When you think Bigfoot, what do you think? I mean, this is just kind of a check-in here to make sure that I'm on the right track, because in all, you remember the grainy footage if you're of a certain age? I remember sitting in a darkened theater, the Shoals Theater on Seminary Street in Florence, Alabama, seeing this grainy footage of this strange sort of half-loping creature running through a sort of swampy northwestern woods. And from that day to this, I have had it in my mind that if Bigfoot, Sasquatch, notwithstanding the fact that the folks who sell a certain brand of maximally processed beef product would like you to think that he's wandering around picnic grounds and golf courses, that Sasquatch was to be found in the Great Northwest. Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, maybe up into that sort of little boat tail hangy down thing that Alaska has. But I guess Bigfoot fever has caught on in a lot of different parts of the country. I mean, we have people who go Bigfoot hunting here in the temperate rainforest of Appalachia, although I can't imagine how the Sasquatch could stand to be near a mountaintop removal site. Wouldn't that be awful if there really was Sasquatch and people like Don Blankenswine and Kevin Crutchfield from Alpha Natural Resources had actually blasted him to smithereens? Yeah. Oh well, we're doing okay without the dodo too. Dodo. not Oklahoma, Stan. Because this story comes out of Rogers County, Oklahoma, Stan. The Rogers County, Oklahoma Sheriff's Department arrested three men after one of them was accidentally shot in the back while hunting for Bigfoot? This is from freakoutnation.com. I'm going to get through this. There will not be any squealing or screaming. It's Morehead Monday. I'm supposed to be able to do this. The three men were hunting Bigfoot late Saturday night when one of them heard a barking noise, which made him jerk and fire his weapon, hitting his friend in the back. Hint. This is why in this general part of the country, you go snipe hunting with a wooden spoon and a saucepan, and you bang the saucepan with the wooden spoon, and you holler, "Here, snipe, 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 snipe." You do not take rifles or shotguns. As that late tome, The Child's Garden of Grass, once put it, games with guns and knives are not advisable. But not for the Bigfoot hunters of Rogers County, Oklahoma. Who didn't want to simply see a Bigfoot or verify the presence of a Bigfoot. Because, see, this is sort of the drill down of Moranity in this story. They took guns out to go Bigfoot hunting. Because, I'll be honest with you. I got a 27-point Boone and Crockett rack hanging on my wall, white-tailed deer. I got everything that swims, flies, walks, or crawls here in Oklahoma. I ain't got no Bigfoot. You damn right I'm going to shoot him. I'm going to shoot him. I'm going to take him down to Bubba's Taxidermy Service. We're going to stuff him standing up real Bigfooty looking, maybe with one hand in the air and a thumb hanging out so we can stick some jerky on his thumb, and we're going to put him right there in the living room. Damn right I'm taking a gun. But the part that grabbed me was the three men were hunting Bigfoot. Okay, once I got over that, late Saturday night, i.e. beer is involved, when one of them heard a barking noise. Does this need, do we need to get a memo out to Oklahoma, Stan, that there are things out in the woods that make barking noises? And they are called dogs? No, Bob, you damned idiot. This is the famous barking Bigfoot of Rogers County, Oklahoma. The three men, as noted in the first paragraph, were arrested. Rogers County Sheriff Scott Walton said, "If they'd just been factual, upfront, and truthful with us and explained that this was truly an accident, as strange as it might sound, we would have went ahead. We would have went ahead. Went ahead. And investigated, and probably nobody would have gone to jail." Oddly enough, in this report, "gone" is placed in brackets, which means that "gone" was not what he said. They probably said, "and probably nobody would have went to jail." The English language is dying before our very eyes and ears. I happened to tune in to the Mountaineer football broadcast this past Saturday, in which my beloved Mountaineers managed to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, but not without trying some, to escape with a win over poor old beaten and bedraggled TCU. So our hunt for a berth in the 2013 Toilet Bowl to be played in, I don't know, the American Family Association's backyard in Tupelo, Mazzuppistan, is still alive. But I was driving down the road when I heard it, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it, but it was something like hearing the color commentary guy. No, it was the play-by-play guy say something like "would of have." There was screaming. But apparently Rogers County Sheriff's deputy, or Rogers County Sheriff Scott Walton, went on to say, you know, when you start off like with an explanation like that, do you believe anything after? Because after the famous call of the barking Sasquatch of Rogers County, Oklahoma, caused one man to shoot another in the back, they did call 911. They met emergency responders on a nearby interstate, because it is well known that when hunting the famous barking Sasquatch of Rogers County, Oklahoma, well, they've been known to thumb rides out on the interstate. What is that, I-40? The wounded man is expected to survive, although it's not yet known whether he will continue to hunt Bigfoot with friends that are defecating in their own pants. And, of course, the punchline comes at the end. News 9 reports, Sheriff Walton said that while authorities cannot locate the weapon that was used, it, quote, probably was an accidental shooting. And then this. This is where the deductive reasoning part of law enforcement comes in. It is not yet known if drugs or alcohol played any part in the accident. Come on, Rogers County Sheriff Scott Walton. Channel your inner Sherlock. I think this is a safe bet. It's Saturday night in Oklahoma. What else is there to do besides get liquored up and go a hunting Sasquatch? Give me another slug of that hooch. By God, if I see one of them, I want to see two, Bubba. Whew. Jim noting, Bigfoot, small brain pan. Thought it was the current Speaker of the House. Sure looks like a barking idiot and coward. Thanks, Jim. Hey, thanks, Henry. Henry just chipped in $20 toward Darlene's challenge. Thank you very, very much. Thanks, Ed and Sal. Even before I announced Darlene's challenge, Ed and Sal had jumped out there, $25 and $10 respectively. Thank you very much. We are throwing spadefuls of earth into the hole and stepping up on it and kind of seeing up over it. Yes, thank you. So let's see. We got Bob Murray. I wonder if he barks. We've got the woman in Craigsville, Virginia, who sees no harm in sending her child dressed up as a Klansman. We have the assistant football coaches from a high school in San Diego who see no harm in putting on blackface and going to a Halloween party as the team from Cool Runnings. Yeah, Mom. Oh, please. You think it's more Ann Monday? You think? Bumper crop. Bumper crop. And it just continues. There's lots of them. This one has a really sad and miserable end. This one comes out, oh Lord, this one comes out of, come on computer, please, pretty please. We'll be there in a minute. This one comes out of Great Britain. And it's one of those stories that you have to go a couple of paragraphs before you find the real reason for it happening. An investigation is ongoing in the UK into the conduct of some British constables and emergency call handlers and various and sundry other officials. It has to do with the story of a man who was an avid gardener as the story repeats. He was an avid gardener and he was dealing with some little hellions in his neighborhood who took joy out of stomping his flowers. And so, upon seeing these little hellions stomping his flowers, he came out with a camera and began to record them. He was doing this in an effort to gather evidence of what they were doing. Instead, however, one of the neighbors dropped the dime on him, and the police came and arrested him. Three police officers showed up and arrested him while the crowd of adults in his neighborhood chanted, "Pedo, pedo, pedo, pedophile, pedo, pedo, pedo," because he was taking photographs of children. So we know the real reason why he was doing what he did. The story comes from The Independent on Sunday in the UK. 3 days afterward, when he was outside, two of his neighbors attacked him and beat him senseless. Still unsatisfied with what they had done, they took the unconscious man into the courtyard, doused him with fuel, and burned him alive. The story hit the papers because the two men who had done it pled guilty to murder last week, as well as assisting in a crime. I think what we would call here either accessory or conspiracy. Want to know why it happened? The man who had the love of flowers was named Bijan Ebrahimi. He was Iranian-born. And apparently this case is not over yet because there are at least six emergency operators who are being questioned as to whether they treated his cries for help with the seriousness that they deserve. I don't know enough about the environs where this story took place, to know whether it is somewhere that, you know, people just generally have IQs south of freezing. Three police officers have been suspended because they refused to help Mr. Ebrahimi as he begged for mercy and assistance. Somebody picks up the phone, drops the dime, or whatever, and says, there's a man taking picture of children. So they jump in the cruiser, they roll over, and they arrest the man without so much as a question. He did get to tell his side of the story, and that's why he was released without charges. By the way, the man was also disabled as a result of a bad back. 24-year-old Lee James attacked him with the assistance of neighbor Stephen Norley. It turns out Mr. James had actually encouraged the children to stomp on Mr. Ibrahimi's flowers. Just to torment him. He had also been subjected to hate crimes for a number of years before he was murdered. What do you make of something? And then, of course, this. A real heartbreaker. It comes out of Missouri. In Missouri, there, for some reason or another, the people who settled Missouri like to give place names of different states. There's a California, Missouri. There's a Mexico, Missouri. And now I find out, to much sadness, that there is a Louisiana, Missouri. It was after midnight on Thursday when Ryan and Kathy Miller woke up smelling smoke in their rec room of their home. They'd fallen asleep watching TV, and apparently bad wiring had done what bad wiring so often will do, and ignited part of the house and set it on fire. The first thing they did was run to call 911. And then, with emergency responders on the scene, Ryan Miller tried to run back in to get his little boy, Riley, who was still asleep in his bed. Police tasered Ryan Miller 3 times to keep him from going back in and saving his little son. You know what? Under the most charitable of circumstances, one would speculate that the police did this to keep him from getting himself killed. But if you are standing outside a burning building where your precious child is in danger of dying, well, I reckon there's a reason they had to taser him 3 times. The first one couldn't prevent him from trying to do whatever he could to get into the home to save his child. Neither could the second. But the third one knocked him down. The police were standing around waiting for the fire department to arrive when they tasered Ryan Miller. And by the time the firefighters got there in their full firefighting gear, the flames inside the house were just too hot to go in and try to rescue 3-year-old Riley Miller asleep in his bed. No, he wasn't asleep in his bed. They found him near the doorway from his bedroom to the front living room. Trying to get out. And the daddy who was trying to save him was laying writhing on the ground, tasered by the police. Thank you, Karen. Karen has kicked in this evening. Thank you. That's $30 answered of Darlene's kindly challenge. Thank you very much, Karen. And thank you, Henry. Let's take a break, sort of, and go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Bob?
What's happening, Jim?
Not a whole lot. That's a pretty grim story you just told.
Yeah. What human being can conceive of it?
I can't. It would appear to me as though the police would have tried to assist the man before the fire department got there to rescue his 3-year-old. I just can't understand that. I mean, they're supposed to be there to protect and serve. Isn't protection part of what they are?
Well, that's what most of the cruisers say, to protect and to serve.
Well, that's a hell of a note to put 3 times 20,000 volts into a man who's trying to save his own child. That's a horrible thing.
I would not want to be that man.
You mean the one who tasered him?
No, I wouldn't want to be him either, but I would, you know.
No. God knows. I mean, you know, lost your child. Most precious thing to have. It's absolutely horrible. But you know these people. I mean, for example, like this guy, and you mentioned somebody's flower beds that were destroyed, and other types of civic harassment, if we can call it that.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the difference between that and what the Brown Church used to do? For example, they would put some type of chemical in front of Jewish shops that caused their dogs to defecate and urinate in the doorway, or the painting of signs, the burning of synagogues. I mean, what's the difference between that kind of mentality and this kind of mentality? Can you explain that to me, please?
Precious little. And again, you know, the two perps were 20-somethings, and they had nice Anglo kinds of names, and I guess they just decided they didn't like Mr. Ibrahimi anymore. And I'm not even okay, Jim, with what? I mean, that's terrorism, isn't it?
Of course it is. I mean, you know, a guy plants a flower bed, he wants to make his domicile more attractive. Not only for himself, for the other people who pass and look by and admire the flowers. And these people have to destroy things of beauty. I don't understand that kind of mentality. I don't.
No, I don't. But I guess the central question, Jim, is whether or not we can say that. I mean, are these just? Well, I'm struggling here, obviously.
Well, I can't blame you, really.
When two people act in concert like this, is it just the dumb luck of the universe that these two hateful people happen to be in the same place at the same time and could murder this man? Or is there something to be gleaned about society from this?
Now, wait a minute. They murdered this guy?
Yeah, they murdered him.
I'm sorry. I didn't catch part of the broadcast. You'll have to...
They dragged him out of his home, beat him into unconsciousness.
After destroying his flower beds, they did.
The children destroyed his flower beds, and then the men who had him hauled away by the police, who immediately released him because he showed them the evidence of the, you know, and they accused him of being a pedophile. Then he gets back home. Then they beat him unconscious, drag him into the estate courtyard, douse him with an accelerant, and burn him alive.
With no due process.
No process at all.
No arrest. No...
No, they had him arrested on an allegation that he was a pedophile because he was taking pictures of their rotten little children stomping his flowers.
Well, boy, that'd be something for discovery in the case, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But the two men have pled guilty to murder, so I don't even know what the penalty for murder is in the United Kingdom. And unless my translation of English English to American English is off, by use of the word estates, am I to understand that this, and our UK friends can answer this, does that mean what we would call here in America the projects?
I'm not sure if they call them estates or not. I'm not sure. I mean, they do have projects and things like that, and they do have public housing, and it's controlled rents and things of that nature. And I'm not sure they call it an estate. I mean,
the news report used that specific phrase. They dragged him to the courtyard of the estate, set fire to him, and burned him alive.
Well, I'm certainly not referring to Downton Abbey or Highclere Castle.
Right, that was kind of where my head was.
Or Highclere Castle, excuse me. No, I wouldn't think so. I don't know. Maybe they're going to give it some type of a name that is less demeaning as far as class is concerned. I don't know. It's language is a funny thing with a lot of people. Well, that's just dreadful. I mean, you know, a person has a right to certain civil liberties as a guarantee and protection of the law until he's found guilty, and then he can be adjudged by a jury of his peers, and then if he's guilty, then sent to his own reward, or not, he's set free, basically. I don't understand that kind of mentality of people. Of course, you know.
But at the bottom line, you know, the reason I suspect that this was done is because the guy was Iranian.
Yeah, probably. I mean, there are a lot of hate groups that are really beginning to surface throughout Europe and throughout this country too. I mean, you know, you have you yourself commented several months ago or last year about the resurgence of the Nazis in Germany, and I'm sure the French have their own equivalent of the same type of party, and there's the same type of party that is in Italy and also Great Britain or the United Kingdom of right-wing people. I mean, you know, like in the 1930s, you had Sir Oswald Mosley in his black shirts, and you see where they went. Luckily, they could put their asses in jail.
Well, and you know, you bring up something that I think is interesting. If this was a story emanating from the United States, we would say without flinching that this was a lynching.
Of course it's a lynching, and, you know, it's just a matter of different trees bearing strange fruit, Billie Holiday used to sing back in the 30s. What's the difference?
Oh, by the way, Ron in Raleigh, with an update on language, he says, the projects are called council houses, estates are an apartment block.
Okay.
So that clears things up a little bit.
All right, I never saw that on Keeping Up Appearances. You've seen that thing on PBS, I'm sure. And nonetheless... So I guess, what's his name, Daisy, and what's her husband's name? You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
the one who's always in bed hitting the TV with a dog that barks at Hyatt, that's, I guess they're called different things, you know?
Right.
I just don't understand that kind of human behavior. I really don't. I mean, there is no point. Of course, you have in this country a black man being tied to a pickup truck with a rope and dragged,
mm-hmm.
at least non-recognizable.
And you know, not just once, but twice. That was Texas, and then again in somewhere near whatever county Florence, South Carolina's in.
Right. And look at what happened to Matthew Shepard. Crucified on the St. Andrew's cross.
And yet, to this day, within the last couple of months, the right wing is still busily trying to reinvent or historically distort what happened there. It was within the last 2 months that we had the sound clip of the right wing religion industry person saying, no, this was not a sexual hate crime. This wasn't because Matthew Shepard was gay. It was a drug deal gone bad.
That simply isn't true.
No, it isn't.
Over the years, I've been in contact with a friend of Matthew Shepard's about that, and he would definitely make a very good appearance on this program to explain that to you and what happened to that young man. It's just another example of man's inhumanity span. That's all there is to it, and these people do it with gusto and glee.
Indeed they do.
And it's a very dreadful thing to have. I mean, that can happen to anybody just because you don't like them, the way they look or the way they, their lifestyle or whatever. I mean, I just got this thing on the internet from, or email from John Boehner because the Senate's going to pass this, pro-gay rights bill.
Yeah, and the Employment Non-Discrimination Act.
Right. So the people can't be fired for, you know, their lifestyle, but only for their performance or lack of thereof, you know.
Well, that damn fool has already declared,
He will not bring it to the floor.
Well, not just that, and he said he won't because in his Merlot-infused haze, he declared that it's already illegal to fire somebody for being gay in America. He said that.
Well, that simply isn't true.
Doesn't slow them down a lick, Jim.
No, it's not. I mean, these people can, oh, take a measure of what they consider you to be, and if they find that you're not like they are or what they perceive that you should be, then they can begin to gather all types of evidence against you, and they can use any part of the, you know, conditions of employment or their job description to, in their own way, to produce some type of non-performance element which is wrapped in this anti-gay or anti-whatever they want to be. I mean, you know, it doesn't relate to just being gay. It just relates to the fact that you've got people in supervisory positions who just don't like an individual for whatever reason, and maybe it's the fact that that person might remind them of something in themselves, and they just want to get rid of them.
Well, it is interesting that in the vote on ENDA in the Senate this evening, 7 Republicans actually voted in favor of the bill to get it over that 60-vote threshold. They were, and their names need to be spoken and spoken well of. They were Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, Susan Collins of Maine, of all people, Orrin Hatch of Utah, Heller of Nevada, Kirk of Illinois.
Orrin Hatch.
Rob Portman of Ohio, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. And on top of it all, Jim, if you can imagine this, Joe Manchin voted in favor of ENDA.
Well, good for him.
Yeah.
You know, there are some good elements to certain people.
The right wing in this state will savage him over that vote, will they not?
I'm sure they will, and I'm sure he realized exactly what risk he was taking as far as his own reelection is concerned, but that's why we send these people to Congress, not to have them reelected. We send them to do a job and to do it right and to represent people and not to condemn them for something that is like that. Good Lord in heaven, I don't understand it. I mean, I'm glad the senator did that.
I am too. I'm quite honestly shocked.
But like I say, Boehner will not bring it to the floor for a vote.
No.
And he can choke it right there and kill it. And no man should have that amount of power. I'm sorry. I have always believed that the Speaker of the House should not have the power to prevent any bill from being brought to the floor for a vote. I mean, I don't understand why how he is given that power constitutionally.
He isn't. The rule, such as it is, that he uses to determine that he will not bring a case to the floor for a vote is the so-called Hastert rule, Jim.
Oh, God, that fat thing from Pennsylvania who was...
Illinois.
Illinois.
Yeah, the sweaty wrestler.
Who was doing anything that would do him, and then he got up in there and was one of the...
Don't use those phrases together, was doing anything that would do him and got up in there. Don't use those two together, Jim. I mean, just buddy to buddy. It doesn't work.
Oh, you're a devil with language, aren't you?
I am.
Nonetheless, I mean, he was one of the House managers, as I recall, when they were trying to impeach Bill Clinton, right?
Right. The fast and furious search for Bill Clinton's... Well, never mind. But no, he enunciated something that is known now as the Hastert rule, that says that no bill will be brought to the floor of the House unless it enjoys the support of a majority of the majority of the House.
Oh dear.
And so that's the same reason that we had the shutdown, Jim.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He used that power, but I mean, that thing needs to be changed. I mean, the Hastert rule isn't written in.
It's not a law. It's not. I mean, if anything, it is nothing but a rule to keep the business of the people from being done.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, when I remembered Hastert, I thought to myself, my God, who could be attracted to you? And they had him in some sort of sexual misconduct thing, didn't they?
Oh, I do believe so.
Oh.
And that, of course, leads to further inquiry into who in God's name would fill in the... Yeah.
You mean who would do that?
Precisely my point.
A fugitive from whatever terrible institute you can imagine with terrible, number one, taste and number one, abilities to see or hear, a fugitive from the Braille Institute. My God, they would even do
no,
that.
No, see, I mean, I think you'd have to have even more of your essential senses blunted. I mean, hear, see, smell, touch.
All the five senses. Absolutely. Everything from visual to olfactory. God in heaven, that was just the meanest looking son of a bitch I've ever seen in my life when he marched in there two by two with his fellow Confederates, and they looked as though, you know, they were going to an execution, and they were down and bound to have it. But it didn't work. Where is that bastard now?
I don't know. The only former Speaker of the House that I've been hearing about lately is Jim Wright. Did you happen to run across this story?
No, sir.
Well, you know, Texas has imposed stringent new fraud-preventing, they claim, voter ID laws. Right? I mean, you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Jim Wright was a Speaker of the House of Representatives a couple of decades back. Well, a decade and a half back.
Mm-hmm.
And with the new Texas law having gone into effect, this 90-year-old man was compelled to go to the Texas DMV to get a photo ID so that he, former Speaker of the House Jim Wright, would be allowed to vote. They denied him, Jim.
The man who was 90 years of age.
Who was a former Speaker of the House. He has voted in every election since 1944.
Upon what grounds? Just prejudice?
His papers were not in order.
Oh, boy. Here we go back to so many other things, like, you know, the same crap they did to...
His driver... See, he's 90, Jim. His driver's license had expired 3 years ago, and being a responsible person, he decided he probably had no further business operating a motor vehicle.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you know...
So he presents his three-year-old driver's license, and they say, oh, we're sorry, but this thing's out of date. It don't count. You ain't voting.
In other words, in Texas, you have to be able to drive in order to vote?
Yeah, sort of, I guess. Because, or you've got to have a valid photo ID, and they get to declare what valid is. I mean, bless his heart, Jim Wright said, nobody was ugly to us, but they made it clear that they were not, they insisted they wouldn't give me an ID.
Well, Lord, Bob, they've got state IDs for people who would have a license.
So he had to turn around, go back, and present a certified copy of his birth certificate. The 90-year-old former Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States. 34 years in Congress. Could not be trusted to cast a ballot in this country, you know, because voter fraud.
My Lord.
Take nothing for granted, Jim.
No, I don't. I have been in that position a long time ago as far as taking nothing for granted. I mean, it's just like the whole country is just going all the straight to hell with all these people in their gerrymandered districts and their prejudices and their dislike of people and their attempt to assume power for the one purpose, and that is not doing the business of the people for which they were elected. That's what it looks like to me.
Well, I mean, this is a sure enough mess, and bless his heart, former Congressman Wright said, I earnestly hope those unduly stringent requirements on voters won't dramatically reduce the number of people who vote. I think they will reduce the number to some extent, and the extent to which they will reduce the number of voters has a decidedly higher melatonin content.
Oh, brown people, huh?
Yeah. Well, either African Americans or Latinos of.
I know very well. I'm surprised they don't have a Chinese newspaper and wax paper with a ballpoint pen that had written in 5 years to produce a literacy and writing content.
Well, pray God, Jim, that nobody from the right wing's listening tonight, because they'll be running out and buying a...
They know that story a lot. Listen, if they could implement that, they sure as hell would. Let me tell you something right now. I used to hear that story growing up from my dad about, you know, when they tried to keep blacks from voting in South Carolina. And, you know, he just sort of told it very wryly and wistfully, but he said, you know, that's exactly what people will do to attempt to get their own way. Come hell or high water, regardless of whom they hurt or whom they disenfranchise or whatever. And that's a dreadful thing. It really is. I mean, what's the difference between that and having to be a member of the Nazi Party in order to hold office, like back in the 1930s, you know? None different whatsoever. I'll answer that question for you.
Yeah, I can't see a hell of a lot. Sandra just tweeted in, Jim, and she said, the Texas GOP vote, these voters, voter suppression laws will stop a lot of voters, and the GOP will keep the House in 2014 and make a good run at the presidency in 16.
Well, she could well be right, absolutely. And if they have their way, they will, because, I mean, once they're determined, they are in lockstep.
Well, look at the guy who got exposed, and you know, it's kind of a sad commentary that we have to look to something like The Daily Show on Comedy Central for substantive reporting, even though they admit it's a fake news program. But they exposed a guy a week or so ago, week and a half maybe, to he was on camera and said, "Oh, what these voter ID laws are going to kick a lot of Democrats' butts, and keep them from voting." I mean, he admitted it to the point that the guy interviewing him said, "You know, we can hear you, right?" Yeah. And then went ahead and dropped the N-word three or four times.
Well, he didn't care.
So that's North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi.
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing is there are a lot of good people in these states, but they're going to be overwhelmed by the bad. It seems as though historically and inevitably that these idiots and these miscreants and malcontents and criminals, and I will use the word criminal because it is criminal behavior in my opinion, always have a way of getting their way. It just is. I mean, didn't we fight two world wars against this kind of thing?
Well, and one civil war.
And one civil war, exactly. I was going to say that. I mean, didn't we? I mean, how many gallons of blood, or I don't know, what is it, 5 pints per man times how many X number of millions is instilled on the ground to make this world a better place so it could ascend into the broader sunlit upland of a better society and a more humane way of doing business and preserving life and guaranteeing the ability of people to have their voices known? But they don't want people to know that. You know, that's the reason they want to kill history, and that's the reason they want to stop it in schools and stuff like that. And that's the reason you have a lot of ignorant people who are running around, deliberately ignorant in many cases, and I guess...
Yeah, what's that phrase you use? Woodenly stupid and stupidly wooden?
Yeah, I've used that quite often myself. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. But that's just horrible. That's it's really dreadful to have people dragged from their homes and burned and things like that. I mean, Bob, this is something like a Vincent Price movie in which this guy is accused of witchcraft and tied to a tree and burned up, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that Roger Corman and John Hill and Wes Craven could really do some good horror stories about some of these real people and not even have to go back to any type of thing about Vertilax or Warlocks or
No, that's right. When the horrors are real, that's the reason, for instance, that the horror movies we have now have to constantly keep one-upping each other. You know, in the 30s and the 40s and especially the 50s, you know, you went from Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney's Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah.
And Bride of Frankenstein.
Boris Karloff,
exactly.
Uh-huh.
And you work your way up into things like The Colossal Man and The Blob and The Fly. And then, in the late 60s, early 70s, you get Night of the Living Dead, you know, shot on a shoestring up in Monroeville, PA, and it's a classic. But there comes a point in time where the culture exceeds the imagination's ability to manifest horror.
Oh, well, the shibboleth of Night of the Living Dead was hit the head, kill the ghoul.
Yeah.
Except the ghouls are the people who have the weapons in their hands, and the people who have a certain degree of power, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I just think of the whole crowd up there as a bunch of zombies. I mean, I don't know if Marie Laveau has come out of her tomb in New Orleans and is, you know, put some dust on them or whatever.
I think this is past even Marie Laveau. I mean, geez.
It's just crazy. I mean, people are acting like they don't have any common sense or any decency.
Well, that's the point. That's the point I was trying to make, Jim. When everyday horrors exceed the ability of Hollywood to imagine them, then that means that Hollywood has to ramp it up. And, you know, eventually in 100 years or so, we probably will have regressed all the way to the days of ancient Rome, and we will get our jollies by watching people die live on, you know, live on broadcast. Who will die tonight? You know, no more who gets voted off the island, who gets eaten by a crocodile.
You know, these altars of faith, so to speak. I mean, it's like we're going back to the days of the Inquisition, which is really, really bad. I mean, the days of Torquemada.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't want to bring the church into this, but it's part of church history. And,
sure it is.
And, you know, it's something that I have trouble with and how they could be so cruel. I mean, you know, I went to... Oh, God, it was someplace in Spain, and I went to a castle, and they actually had these instruments of torture laid out. And it was just, I mean, I thought to myself, what type of sick mind would be able to design and implement something like this or make it? And, you know, it's basically, I think people are becoming so inured to, well, shit happens. That they don't give a flying fig, because as long as it doesn't happen to them,
well, we are on full out information overload, and we're on horror overload.
Yeah, basically, what it results in is the inability of people to be compassionate, to be sensible, and to be the very things that they should be, that are so-called, you know, preached by these individuals who would have find themselves in the company back in the 16th and the 15th centuries of witch finders and the architects of the auto de fe and the burning and torture. And that's something that's coming back. They are appealing to the very basic elements of our nature. Really, really are. And they're trying to take it all away, any type of form of humanity whatsoever. And that's the reason I'm going to get off here, because other people want to talk. If you can conjure up that song by John Cale, "They're Taking It All Away," who was a friend of Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground.
Right.
If you can find that, if you can find the time to play it, it'd be much appreciated.
Well, if that opportunity presents, I will definitely try. Jim, thank you very much, and have a good evening.
Likewise, sir.
Bye now. And that, of course, is the inimitable Jim. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Another guy.
Hey, what's happening, Bill?
Oh, it's been a rough day. I made a big mistake this morning. I emptied some ashes into a plastic bag, and I took off downstairs. When I came back up, I had a nice little smoking fire in my apartment, and it burned 10 or 12 inch hole in the rug. But I called the fire department to be safe. I put it out with, you know, water, but I called them, and of course now I'm on the shit list. Because
well, it's not like you were smoking in bed.
No, I never did. That's one thing I never did. I don't know why. I just never. I had heard too many. You know, you hear stuff from when you're old enough, like I was, say in the late 40s, and that's, you heard so many things about smoking in bed that I just never did it. It never was, you know. Oh, in later years, you might have shared a cigarette with some young woman or the other, but never a habit. Watching TV in bed was never a habit with me. I have this problem of falling asleep.
No, I'm a big one for reading in bed.
That was a thing for me, yeah. I have one of my...
I read until the words begin to swim on the page, put the book down, and out.
And the new reading machines that the government brought out... within the last 5 years are rectangular. It's a rectangular piece like a CD, and it's very easy to operate. The old ones were four-channel cassette tape players.
I was going to say, please don't say 8-track tape.
No, please.
Yeah, see, we have a common response.
The government worked hard to develop this this reading unit for people. But anyway, the fire department came. They said, well, you got all these. I got a lot of power strips. And they were getting down on those. And I said, hey, those things are all fused. What the hell? And there isn't that much power being operated. You know, how much of the current does the PA system, a monitor, and speakers run? You know, on a 20-amp circuit?
Yeah, not right.
Well, that's what bothers me, is some of these official people think that they can BS you. But, you know, I did TV work and a lot of electronic stuff, so I'm hard to BS. If I had my way, I'd get the hell out of Cuyahoga County and get back to Lake, because they have a bus transit system that'll pick you up and take you anywhere in the damn county. I used to go to the Y. Right after my eyes went bad, I was still going to the Y just about 5 days a week. I wasn't setting any world records. I wasn't hauling any railroad cars with my teeth. But the workout, you know, and a good steam and shower and shave was a great thing for the to keep the positive thing going in you. But anyway, that's my story. The stuff you had tonight, this stuff in England. England's had a history of crazy stuff like this. We don't really think about it, but they have their, what was the Teddy Boys in the 60s? Every ounce of juvenile delinquency in the 50s and 60s here. The big difference today with kids is the amount of firearms. That's the difference. The worst thing that I ever...
Yeah, consider, for instance, now I guess he doesn't qualify as a juvenile because the guy was 23 years old, but Mark just sent me a photo and a description of the guy who went on a shooting rampage at LAX, remember, Friday evening?
Yeah,
he was carrying a manifesto or something that said F you to what he referred to as Bull Dyke Janet Napolitano.
Oh, for God's sake.
And homophobic rants. And I mean, yeah, this is one of theirs. But it is almost like 99.9% of the time it's one of theirs.
This is what happens when you have these right-wing hate hawkers going at you.
So, well, this is, you know, these are... You know, there was a very famous play that came out, late 60s, early to mid 70s, called Kennedy's Children.
Yeah.
And it was a brilliant piece of theater. I was actually involved in it at one point in time on a college campus. Well, this guy who shot up LAX, this is Alex Jones's children. These are Glenn Beck's children. These are Rush Limbaugh's children. Yep. These are Hannity's children. These are Janet Parsall's children.
If all you hear is hate and negativity, my one health aide, who's she's always down on me, says, you're so negative. I said, well, this is what's going on. What can I tell you? You think I made this stuff up? But then, you know, you don't see it. She doesn't read newspapers anyway. And even if she did, you wouldn't find it there. You have to... I can take you back to a guy you may never have heard of, Dean Clarence Mannion. He was a dean of Notre Dame Law School, and he ran a spiel show on Sunday nights, and it was this right-wing hardcore stuff, only it was all dressed up in legalese and good old Americanism. But it wasn't as hateful as... the guys you just mentioned.
Yeah, he was no Father Coughlin either, I guess.
No, well, he was... I wish I could see if anybody could ever find these two commercials that Saxby was using in 68 when he ran for Senate, because I happened to be paid to play on them. And one was kids throwing signs, it's called Signs of the Times, and it was kids throwing rocks, college-age and high school kids throwing rocks... stuff, and the other was American Eagle exploding in fire and smoke while I played that English drinking song.
Yes.
That one. And I didn't ever think that these people would be back with the kind of vengeance there are. There was a guy the other night, he was, well, the guy who was running the old night show that the guy from Nevada used to run in the beginning, you know, the Fleischer's the Landed show. Nori does it now.
Art Bell.
But this was a substitute for Nori, and he had a writer on who just did a book on the Dulles brothers, Alan and George Foster, you know,
mm-hmm.
and was painting them to be the heroes of our time. The guys who wanted to launch Operation Vulture in 1954, I guess it was, to bomb the hell out of Jep's men around Dien Bien Phu. They wanted the United States Air Force to launch B-29 strikes, because I don't think they were flying the 52 yet. And at first they were going to use atomic weapons to destroy the Viet Minh Communist Army. Of course, they would have destroyed whatever the other guys that were close by, too, of course, but they didn't think about
that. Yeah, that's the thing about nuclear war.
And the guy that kind of bailed us out of that one was... a guy who had his own military leanings whenever he was up for budgeting, and that was Matt Ridgway. Yeah, but he told Ike, he says, what's in this for us? Because Ike gave him the idea to study, and that his idea was, are you shitting me, you know, basically. So every once in a while, a guy will pop out of... and I don't know if I mentioned it to you that I found out the Japanese naval unit was had a load of chemical... insects and, you know, germ warfare that they were gonna throw at the Marines on Saipan. And the ship sank. Now, I don't know if it was sunk by an American submarine or what. Because that's another thing that never gets talked about. The American submarine service in the Pacific in World War II just devastated the Japanese. Because that nation had no business, no chance going to war. When you look at the population and the industry and their industry was so bad they were having people go get pine oil out of pine trees because they couldn't get oil from anywhere else. And yet the militarists would have fought to the last drop of somebody else's blood. And theirs, I mean, I'll give them credit for that. They were very willing to commit seppuku, you know. So.
Sure.
But, yeah, the Dulles brothers are not my two favorites. And the commercial, me and my buddies used to listen to...
Yeah, I like the Marx Brothers a lot better than the Dulles Brothers.
Yeah, well, I used to listen to Limbaugh, and there were parts of Frogman Henry's I Ain't Got No Home was a great song, but unfortunately not in the service of Limbaugh. And for him to play the Pretenders thing as a theme, you talk about irony or ridiculousness. They do one of her things. I think she cut a version of Four Dead in Ohio on one of her albums, Chrissy. I haven't seen her. She every once in a while does a live show and she'll ask if, is that old buzzard still around? But yeah, it's reached a point that, I don't know. I just don't know. Jim is so on the money tonight that, you know. Because I wish I was going to be around to see the end of the movie, you know. Maybe I wouldn't like it. Because they have working class people, especially Caucasian working class people, convinced that whatever's going on is somebody else's fault. And the somebody else's they'll come out and name and lean on. And I know you and I and a lot of others are not as happy with the president as we could be, as we thought we were going to be. But a fake's a fake. Yeah, this ID stuff is reaching the point of ridiculousness, you know, to have to run out and get it. I don't have a driver's license anymore, and everybody should be thankful for that. And,
But remember, the NRA would like for you to be able to have a gun.
Well, I wouldn't mind having one, but because my philosophy was always, people would brag to me about, my gun can hit a guy a block away, but then what do you tell the judge, for Christ's sake?
Well, we were lobbing him in, Your Honor.
Yeah, I mean, if a man's next to me and he's going to start choking me, and the guy's got powder burns all over his shirt and everything else, at least I can, you know, I can say, well, he was attacking me. And self-defense is, because this running away stuff, you wonder how far Trayvon Martin, if he had turned away, well, he would outrun that asshole, that's for sure.
You can't out, but the thing is, you can't outrun 1,900 feet per second muzzle velocity.
Yeah, that's the problem. And I hear a lot of people I've known for years are out getting guns and passing the tests and all that. And they were the ones that couldn't understand why when I was working until the middle of the night, God knows where and when, and a car breaks down in the wrong neighborhood, anything can happen kind of situation. And that's a reality if you're... I did security in places where, well, in fact, they just popped about 10 smack dealers up here in Euclid, Ohio last week, and a few others in other places, because that stuff has made a big, big comeback. Something I thought I'd never see make this kind of, you know, incursion into American drug culture. But then again, what happened? What do they grow over there, you know? Where we've been fighting against those.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do they grow big over there? Poppies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Poppies. Poppies.
Yeah, exactly. So that answers that. But anyway, I'll let you go and give somebody else some room here. But Jim was on it tonight. There's no doubt about it that there are people in this country who just can't see past the end of their nose. And the story about the Texas. What was his name, the former House of Representatives?
Oh, Jim Wright?
Yeah, what they made...
Yeah, he was Speaker of the House during, I guess, the second Reagan administration?
Yeah, yeah. Because I remember Limbaugh attacking him unmercifully, too. And they just...
Well, he was run out of office for things that Newt Gingrich did and only chuckled about.
Well, when I listened to Dr. Bill, it's like, yeah, you look back at the guys that were working on the Constitution, a lot of them were working for their own benefit on everything they could do.
Well, yeah, consider today's installment of the Virtual Center for the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Holy mackerel.
Yeah. And my health aide's sitting here, and she's looking puzzled. She says, well, how do you understand that stuff? Gee, he didn't delve into a foreign language, did he? I mean... That I missed somehow?
No, no.
I had it. The Lord translated it into English for me. You know? Oh well.
Anyway. Glory.
The what?
Glory.
Yeah, exactly.
Pass me the snake.
Because when you read these, like my grandmother, my mother's mother, cried her eyes out when the truth came out about the Holocaust, because she had left Germany in like 1890 something, 95, 98, you know, and came here. And she just couldn't believe this. Because I think they kept that pretty quiet over here, didn't they?
Most of America didn't learn about the Holocaust until the newsreel footage of the American troops
breaking into these
liberating the camps became known.
Yeah.
And then at that point, it was only a fraction of what had actually happened.
Well, there was an American pilot that got out of the Philippines, and man, he came over here and he spilled his guts, and you know, knowing so many, I have met very many Japanese students. When you play on a college campus, you meet a lot of kids from foreign countries, and you know, I was at a seminar of some kind of trade deal up in Toronto one time. I stopped by and I was talking with Japanese business types, and I don't think they know what went on in their country, what went on, you know, in the hands of the people who were controlling the country, because they don't talk about it much. They don't educate their children to Nanking, et cetera, you know? And
exactly.
My pet theory, I'll let you go, was that I look around at the countries that were really active in the 20th century with military stuff. They were... And it included us to a degree, the last countries to arrive on the international scene, Germany, U.S., Japan, they really had a finger on the trigger. Of course, I don't know what your belief is in the start of the, you know, the Japanese war. Did you think that Roosevelt and them knew it was coming and where? I think they kind of was they were worried about something. Because I said the almost
I mean the whole Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor. That stuff's been thoroughly debunked. It's a right wing talking point.
I thought it was pretty well. I think the in some respects they were for some reason they were worried about what was going on in Europe and I think the only thing that would have made Japan a target for us was that everybody wanted to get into China and work the crap out of people for very little money. I mean, there's a lot of Chinese who are making out quite well in their current economy, but there's a lot of them who are still not exactly getting rich. What's the one place that had a net around the building?
Oh, you mean the manufacturing complex for iPhones?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, don't try to reduce the incidence of suicide. Just put nets around the building for when they jump.
Well, that does reduce the suicide, doesn't it?
No, it means that they have to figure out a way to jump further.
Oh, okay. They can't get out. Oh, they just leave them up there.
Yeah, I mean, you can't just go right out the window. You've got to get that whole Acapulco cliff diving, you know, springing outward action going on.
Well, I thought maybe they would pluck them out and say, get back to work.
Well, they do. That's the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
You don't even get the day off for attempting suicide.
Jesus, you don't get the rest of the day
and,
off.
And let's understand that while that was the Apple factory, the same kind of brutality happens in almost every... And see, these are city-sized plants.
Yes.
I don't think we can even conceive of the scale, Bill.
Nope.
These are city-sized plants. And it doesn't matter if it's Apple or Samsung or Nokia. Well, maybe not Nokia. They're doing that stupid Windows phone.
The Finns used to make.
Yeah, that was Ericsson, I believe.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Nokia.
Maybe it was Nokia. I thought I had a.
But Windows, you know, Microsoft bought a big chunk of them, and so now every phone that they make is a Windows phone, and why, seeing here how god-awful Windows 8 is, why anybody would want that on a phone is simply beyond me.
I live in fear of when this stuff of mine is going to die, because I have what you were running last year. Both computers have that, what was it called?
The XP?
XP, yeah, that was, because I know people who, I started with what, 300 or something like that. I don't know what it was when my first computer was set up.
Oh, I started with, what was it, Windows 3.11 for that, warehouses?
Yeah, that was it, yeah. Yeah, that was a 3.11. I assembled the damn things for a buddy of mine, but where he messed me around is he never taught me to configure, which, of course, I couldn't do now anyway, but assembly was no problem at all.
Yeah, and by the way, Sparky reminded me in the chat room, the people who do the work for Apple and ever so many of these other manufacturers is Foxconn. It was the Foxconn campus where people were leaping and had to be...
Foxconn?
Foxconn.
Well, I thought that was a TV network, the con part.
He'll be here all week. Try to be.
Hey, anyway, you take care of yourself.
All right, you too, Bill. Have a good night.
Good night.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. So much perspective he brings. It is 20 minutes past the hour on this Moran Monday here on the Horn. And we are still looking for the seven folks at $10 apiece who will match that which has been put out there already by Henry and by Sal and by Karen. To get us going up to the challenge that Darlene issued this evening. She's got $100 if people can pull together $100 and That'll get us about halfway out of the hole. So, if you can, thank you very much. BetOnRadioNetwork.com is where you go to find the PayPal button. And, by the way, a note coming in from both Randy and Ron. Randy says, don't wait until April of 14 to get off of XP. Everyone and his brother will be down at Staples trying to upgrade. Upgrade to Windows 7 now. And Windows 7 is pretty stable. It looks a little different from XP, but it's manageable. Windows 7 may actually be the best that they ever did, although some say that about XP. Ron says Windows stops supporting XP April 2014. You know, word to the wise is sufficient. So thanks, Ron, and thanks, Randy. Much appreciated. Got a couple of pieces of, well, I've got a story that I want to, well, you may already know about it, whatever. We're going to cover it anyway. But I want to go to the mailbag real quick. Friday night, on Friday on the front porch, I had a note after the program from two different residents of Alberta, Canada. And apparently we, in the conversation, rubbed them both the wrong way. Lauren wrote in and said, hey, Bob, Alberta is still part of Canada, not full of racists like your man Chris on Skype said. Edmonton, where I live, is nothing like what he described. Unfortunately, it is one of the most conservative parts of Canada, but we do have gay marriage, free health care, and the air here is not terrible. Yet, as we are far enough away from Fort McMurray and the Tar Group, way too many guys in pickup trucks, no gun racks, though, and certainly minimal, if any, gun violence. I doubt the Skype group member from Vancouver has ever actually been here. The University of Alberta here is fairly well thought of. There is some tuition, but not like in the U.S. Yes, we're desperate for workers here. Can't get construction workers, etc., to save your life here in Edmonton, because everyone goes up to the tar sands. Environment? What environment? Speaking of the U.S., Lauren says, my family there tells me that one works for 2 years between undergrad and grad school. It's just what is done. One niece has been at Goldman Sachs working in the ethics department since she got her undergrad degree. Yes, my head did explode. Who knew Goldman Sachs had an ethics department? And on, you know, which level of the sub-basement, in which corner is it placed? And then we'll do her law school, and I think Goldman Sachs will pay for part of her tuition. Oh, Lordy, that'll come with a price. Thanks, Lauren. Thanks for the input. And then, at greater length, Kelly, signing off as Kelly, proud Canadian citizen, says, hi, Bob. We've never met before, but I thought it was about time since I've been listening to your program for years and considering your Friday night subject matter. See, I'm from Calgary, Alberta, so we've got Edmonton and Lauren and Kelly and Calgary. Born and bred, we are the Canadian equivalent of hillbillies, living as we do in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. It is commonly called the Bible Belt. I'm a progressive, and as your friend in Vancouver correctly points out, there is no progressive media here other than the CBC. That is why I listen to you. So you can imagine my dismay when I heard the stream of stereotypes, half-truths, and outright bullshit that issued from your program on Friday. Don't hold back, Kelly. My entire life, I've lived with the words, don't bash Americans, they're our friends, words that most Canadians live by. And yet more and more often I hear Americans bashing Canadians. I never thought that I would hear such coming from the horn. Didn't feel like we were bashing, but it's conversation, especially on Friday on the front porch. Yes, we have problems here, just as there are everywhere else in the world. In Alberta, we've had a conservative government for 40 years. That would be tough to swallow. To make matters worse, our current federal government is also conservative. And you guys think you had it tough with W in office for 8 whole years. My heart bleeds. There are many, many good people here. This is not a bastion of racism. That is a common stereotype along the lines of all hillbillies is stupid inbred hicks. Alberta is a very multicultural place, far more, in fact, than anywhere in the U.S. that I'm aware of. The only cultures that I hear about in the States are white, Latino, black, and other, with the whites trying to eliminate the others by any means and as quickly as possible. Here we have embraced cultures from all over the world, usually refugees from conflicts caused by U.S. foreign policy. And we don't have the specter of slavery hanging over our heads as you do. We do not import people from poor countries to slave in the tar sands. We have more than enough poor people here who are willing to risk their lives and health to make a living. Just as the people who mine your coal and remove the tops of your mountains, here we call that strip mining, and it's illegal. If people come here to work, they do it of their own free will. Are the people here happy about hydraulic fracturing and oil sands exploitation? Not by a long shot. Unfortunately, the conservative government has sold us out to corporate concerns, most of whom are American. Alberta is what the conservatives call pro-business, the same conservatives who rammed NAFTA down our throats against our will. Trans-Canada Pipelines, or TCPL as we say here, is the very model and essence of the evil corporation and is widely despised. I would put them in the same strata as Monsanto or many other American companies such as Koch Industries, and we have just as much control over them as you do yours. I've heard it said that the Keystone Pipeline is only an issue that exists because we won't allow a pipeline to the Pacific. Quite true. What's your point? TCPL decided to take what they considered to be the path of least resistance by running the pipeline through the U.S. After all, it is much easier to purchase a politician or two in the States than it is here. We take such shenanigans very seriously. If the Keystone Project proceeds, Americans will have no one to blame but themselves. So get off it, okay? If you want to stop it, get off your high horses and do something about it, as we did. I'm going to stop here. Sorry for rambling. You're not rambling, Kelly. I am not normally given to long rants, but I felt that I needed to stand up for myself after your Friday night program. If you came here to visit, I'm certain that you would find the people and the landscape delightful, and not dissimilar to that of your beloved Appalachia, albeit colder. And you would be welcome here. You can go to a football game without being concerned that the person sitting next to you is packing heat. If you're injured or get sick, we'll take care of you. For free. You should always take care when engaging in the application of stereotypes and unknowns. You just may be applying them to your own friends. Warmest regards, Kelly, proud Canadian citizen. And I personally apologize for any scurrilous commentary that issued from my mouth. Obviously, I've not been to Alberta. All I know is that, you know, part of it, hell on earth is being unleashed. And it is deeply troubling to me because, well, it looks like what mountaintop removal would look like if it was just flat. Hell on earth, see above. And just as an odd happenstance, I actually considered at one point in time trying to get into the University of Calgary. Because I was told that at the time, this would be the 80s, they had as good or better of an archaeology program than anywhere in the northern hemisphere of the western hemisphere. That went by the boards, but yeah, I did a little research way back when you actually had to go to the library to do research and couldn't just punch it up on, you know, the interweb tubes. A big truck. So thank you for the input, both Kelly and Lauren. And we will, I'll try to personally be a little more careful. And then, just to put a little punctuation on the whole thing, there's a P.S. to Kelly's note. Those effing assholes in British Columbia have their heads up their asses and don't have an effing clue. We have regional rivalries here as well. Thanks, Kelly. Oh, goodness me. Thank you very kindly, Brian, for jumping in. That pushes us to $40 and only 60 to go to meet Darlene's challenge. Thank you very, very kindly, Brian. And Randy observes, I thought Friday's Canadian content was being mostly by a fellow Canadian. And I'm not passing the buck here. It was, but what I take personal responsibility for is my own ignorance, my own lack of knowledge. But I think there's truth in what Kelly says, about the fact that the TCPL wants to go south because it's easier to buy off a bunch of money-grubbing right-wing teabagging freaks,
drill, baby, drill,
than it is to try to corrupt their own government. They might actually get busted doing that. Although, to be fair, it's got to get from, what was it, Fort McMurray, to the 48th parallel? It's got to get to the U.S.-Canadian border. But then, you know, they had assumed it was going to be smooth sailing until a few people started speaking out about it. So there's that. But yeah, I know that there. Oh Lordy, like I used to say, one of the biggest mistakes was when Canada decided not to allow the Turks and Caicos Islands into the Commonwealth. I could have very easily been a Caribbean Canadian. Although I only saw Grand Turk. I'm told that Providencial is quite nice. Then again, I was on the island for an hour and looked like Captain Pike after the nuclear, I don't know, dilithium crystal accident. It burnt up. So maybe I'm just supposed to be where I'm supposed to be. Another email. This one, and far more seriously, this one from our buddy Steve. And it is directed largely to the Horn family commune. I'm writing for a couple of reasons, Steve says. I have some fairly good news. I've secured a contract to work for a law firm here in New York City. This is just in time because I'm behind in rent and, you guessed it, the landlord's on my tail. Bob, I'm sorry to vent again to the Horn family, but I've got nowhere else to look to. As I attempt to weather this last storm regarding the rent, I can't help but think about that finger of accountability being waved in my face. Isn't it funny how it gets waved in working people's faces, and it never gets waved in the face of the 1%? More on that. I have had to ask my church for help in paying my rent. This is so damned humiliating for me. And yet I'll say editorially that it should not be, because that is supposed to be that's supposed to come as naturally to the church as breathing. It's the whole reason for being. In this regard, Steve continues, I'm asking the Horn family for a gut check. Am I a whiner? Am I a deadbeat? Why does it feel like every day is a struggle for regular people? Why does it feel like we never get a break? You know, my father's paid so much for me and helped me out so much. Again, here I am, 42 years old. Am I unusual for asking for help so late in life? Again, I am asking for a Horn gut check. I really want people to respond. Finally, I'm going to say something about the Horn. I intentionally do not listen to the Friday podcast when there is one because I need, yes, need to hear you, Bill, Jim, Sandra, Kevin, and all the others, just to get myself through the day. So I save the Friday podcast for Monday. I really need you folks. Sometimes I can't get out, so I need some familiar people to listen to and hear. The Horn has become that important to me. To all the Horn family, thank you. So, if you want to respond by email, I'll share your email on air. Or if that's what you want, I'll forward it to Steve. Either way, he's reaching out to family, and he wants some input. And you just heard what the input he wants is. He continues, though, Steve does, on a brighter note, I listened to Cassie calling in on Friday. Bob, this young woman is such an inspiration. I wish I had in my whole body the amount of courage and guts she has in her pinky finger. She is such an inspiration, and I confess I will think of her often as I struggle to get back on my feet. In addition, as I listened to the whole law school choice conversation, I couldn't help but want to get involved. I was going to suggest a couple of things that she may want to consider. As I recall, she said that Columbia in New York was her first choice. She should be prepared for the very corporate Wall Street atmosphere that exists on that, ironically, Harlem campus. If she is interested in public interest law, she may want to consider City College in New York. The law school there is particularly public interest oriented. If she must or prefers to work for a year, she could work for City Year, which is a group that works in depressed neighborhoods. They're frequently in my neighborhood, doing public and community service. It would allow her to get her feet wet in that realm. In addition, if she is interested in prisoner rights work, immigration is particularly good, particularly since good representation for detained immigrants is difficult to find. NYU and my alma mater, Seton Hall, have very good immigration clinics. These folks, particularly asylum seekers, truly are working against the power of our Christian America. In addition to the New York route, American University in D.C. has a pretty good public interest nonprofit program. Regarding nonprofits, generally, working at these places is very competitive. For this reason, they often have the pick of the litter for those who want to work there and often choose from the Ivy Leagues, which is probably why they think they know better than us peasants out here in the real world. This is the reality, though. Finally, going back to Texas is not all bad for law school. UT does have one of the best schools in the nation. In addition, some awfully ballsy liberals have come from Texas. Molly Ivins, Jim Hightower, and Mike Papantonio, to name just a couple. With warmest regards for the Horn family, Steve. So, shoot me a note, bobkincaid@gmail.com, if you want to if you would be so kind as to respond to Steve's inquiry. And I'll either read it on the air or pass it along after the show. Thanks, Jack. Thanks very much for your kind contribution. We're getting ever closer to meeting Darlene's challenge. It means a great deal. We need $40 only to finish off that challenge that Darlene initiated this evening. Thank you. And now, a couple of stories. One of them comes from Jude. And it was really, really thought-provoking when I read it. She wrote simply, "I wonder how the wealthy families will handle this one." It's an AP story out of Delaware. It reads as follows. The former headmaster of an elite private school in Wilmington, Delaware, has surrendered to state police to be charged with dealing, not viewing, but dealing in child pornography. Authorities said 53-year-old Christopher Wheeler turned himself in on Friday afternoon, one day after authorities said they were searching for him. Wheeler stepped down as headmaster of Tower Hill School last week after the Attorney General's office searched his home and school office as part of a child abuse investigation. Detectives with the State Child Predator Task Force secured an arrest warrant for Wheeler on Wednesday, charging him with 25 counts of dealing in child pornography. He's being held on $1.5 million cash bail. Authorities say an examination of computers that were seized during the searches recovered multiple images of child pornography. Jude then did some digging around to find out a little bit more about the Tower Hill School. They state of themselves, "Tower Hill School is committed to keeping tuition rates as reasonable as possible." without sacrificing the quality of education upon which our reputation is founded. We want to provide the best teachers and the best educational experience possible for your child.
Here's how much the best educational experience for your child costs. Half a day at Tower Tots is $9,200. If you want to send them for a full day to kindergarten at Tower Tots, it's $13,750. Oh, wait, no, that's just daycare. Then there's pre-kindergarten. Half day, $13,100. Full day pre-kindergarten, $18,850. Pre-kindergarten. Kindergarten itself is $18,850, and there ain't no half day. Grade 1, $20,075. And it stays that way to grade 5, at which point the tuition goes to $22,275. Grade 6, $22,850. Grade 7, $24,125. It stays that way in grade 8. Grade 9, $25,850. Grade 10, $26,425. And it is the same for grades 11 and 12. That's just the tuition. Then there's the dining room charges. For lunch, $895 for Tower Tots and pre-kindergarten.
Because, you know, my God, Muffy, we can't be sending Precious Lumpkin off to those god-awful public schools. Who knows what kind of terrible habits they'll be picking up there. My God, I cannot bear to think about it. Muffy, my love, my angel, my dear. Can you imagine them rubbing elbows with ordinary people? I know, I didn't say it to hurt you, darling.
Yeah, I think Jude's right. You got to wonder how these one percenters are going to handle the fact that their headmaster at their elite school has been out there dealing kiddie porn. They will burn his ass till there ain't nothing left but ashes, and they'll grind them into the dirt.
I demand to know who is responsible here. Who hired this poltroon? No, of course, we understand he was not dealing in kiddie porn from any of our precious children. Those were probably just little third world waifs, I understand. But the fact that he was in contact with our precious darlings.
Jeez.
See, I reckon our boy here probably made a pretty tasty salary as a member of the, or as the headmaster of the Tower Hill School.
But he was working for the 1%. It is damn sure a certainty that he was still just the help. And yeah, it's true. I'm sure the kiddie porn he was dealing with was child pornography that he was dealing with was stuff that was shot of children who were the product of disastrously shattered homes. Children who didn't have a fighting puncher's chance from the moment they emerged from the womb. Children who would not know what it is to see $850 worth of food in 5 years of their lives, let alone one. but Muffy, we must get Precious Lumpkin into the Tower Tots program. She, well, my goodness gracious, she could eat. Well, she'll fall behind. Doesn't that just make you want to gag? Well, I mean, you know, freedom and everything, right? I mean, if you can afford to send your child somewhere that costs $26,000 per, I don't know, is this a semester? Is this for the full school year? They probably churn out a pretty damn decent education. But the inherent elitism of thinking that your child is too good to attend public school is not something of which any American should be proud. And me, and I'm going to say this, and maybe, I don't know, maybe you'll think it's hateful. I hope not. It's just the way my mind works. The police is in possession of a 25-count indictment for dealing in child pornography against you. 25 counts. It's enough to put you away for a very long time. And barring anything except outright acquittal, you are never going to be around a child for the rest of your life, so your teaching career and your headmastering career is pretty much toast. And even if you are acquitted, your headmastering career is pretty much toast. Because the taint of the charge is enough. And so it was that it occurred to me to ask, if the guy's actually guilty, why didn't he just off himself? There's nothing left. I doubt if he's so awash in remorse that he wants to go to prison and all that going to prison as a kiddie porn purveyor will entail. I'm sure Delaware State Prison is no more of a walk in the park than most any other state prison in the United States, whether it be in California or Louisiana or Alabama or New York or Massachusetts or Michigan. At that point in time, you're done, aren't you? And in some cultures, the right thing to do would be to, you know, say goodbye. Cue up Andrea Bocelli and, well, there you go. Sarah Brightman. Steve noting Tower Tots, $850 in food. I'm going to be sick. I literally have no words. But that's not just that school. There's all kinds of elite private academies all over this country that have similar price structures. So that Precious Lumpkin won't have to get out there and rub elbows with the hoi polloi, with the filthy proles. By the way, a note to Steve from Jim. All my best to Steve in his effort to survive. So I think Steve, you can take that as a vote of confidence on your gut check. Every day in this country, there are people who ask the fundamental existential question of whether it's worth it to go one more day.
There are entire support systems that say you don't have to think about making it 10 years, 15, 20 years down the road. Just get through tomorrow. And they're not asking that essential existential question because they are heinous, bad human beings. They're just weary from the struggle day in and day out. Hellish choices made between food and medicine, between electricity and gasoline, between water. And the insurance bill. And people agonize over this stuff. And a guy charged with 25 counts of dealing in child pornography thinks so highly of his own existence that he turns himself in and is now sitting in jail waiting to see if somebody will go his $1.5 million bail so that he can enjoy some degree of freedom until such time as he either pleads guilty or is found guilty or, long odds, acquitted. It is very easy to see oneself as a member of the 1% when one is really only their bootblack. There's something in that holy book about those who love their lives shall lose them. A tweet coming in from Sandra. Robert Reich says only the top 10% matters to D.C. And the rest, well, F off and die. What does Edward Arlington Robinson say? And so we miss the meat and curse the bread. Yeah. Jim pointing out, FDR stated 60 years ago, people eat from day to day, not month to month or year to year. On the day after Halloween, $5 billion instantaneously disappeared from the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program, SNAP, food stamps, EBT, whatever you want to call it. It just gone. Disappeared. And how many of the people who can afford $850 per term for the Tower Tots lunch program, let alone the $12,000 or so the program itself costs in tuition, how many of those people you think sat around their drawing rooms saying, oh my God, these useless eaters are going to be the end of us? I had a note from our buddy Dennis in Kentucky that put a ton of this into perspective for me. If you make $50,000 per year, you pay out in taxes $247.75 for defense. You pay out $235.81 for Medicare. You pay out $43.78 a year for retirement and disability to government workers. You pay out $36.82 a year for SNAP. You pay out $22.88 a year for unemployment insurance. You pay out $3.98 a year for natural disaster relief. That's FEMA. You pay $6.96 per year for welfare.
But if you make $50,000 per year, you pay $4,000 a year in corporate welfare subsidies. By God, it's those welfare people and those food stampers with their oh my God, with their Alaskan king crab. Well, I think we're all ready for tomorrow's Titanic Tuesday, aren't we? Thanks, everybody, for a wonderful evening. This one's flown by. Thank you very much to Joe and Randy and Michael, to Janie and Darlene and Jack and Jeremy. Thank you all. Thank you to Sal. Thank you to Ed. Thank you to Henry. We have met Darlene's challenge, which was occasioned on the kindness of Janie. And we are digging our way out of the hole. Thanks very, very much. Thanks, of course, go out to all of you for your ideas, your kind contributions, your communications, your emails, your tweets, your Facebook postings. They all contribute to the larger universe of information and conversation that is the Horn Family Commune. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox and to Ben Birch. Thanks go out to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHE.ACT.ORG, ACHE.ACT.ORG. That's where you go to help us bring an end to the nightmare that is mountaintop removal in Appalachia. If you want to support the only proposed law out there that would end mountaintop removal, go to ACHE.ACT.ORG and take action with regard to your member of the House of Representatives and your members of the United States Senate. Thank you. And always, always, always. Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.